Our world is an oak tree. Its trunk grows in the fertile soil of everything before it. A rich, diverse history of social movements, power struggles, wars, innovations. All of the forces, sometimes agreeing, sometimes opposing one another, that brought us to where we are today. And our world is laden with acorns, the seeds of possible futures, each one with its own DNA. Trends and culture and behavior, pockets of power, webs of relations spinning and unspinning themselves, the future could grow from any combination of the seeds within our present. This is why we speculate. Speculative fiction is a tool of the imagination, one which allows us to enter these possible futures and to draw out their implications. The stories may be pessimistic or hopeful, dystopian or utopian, or anywhere in between. But the idea is that any one of these stories could be ours in the future, if things go a certain way. Many would say that solarpunk started with speculative fiction. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it's my favorite genre to read. So it's very exciting that my guest for this episode is one of my favorite speculative authors. Ruthanna Emeris has long been known to the weird fiction community for her reimaginings of Lovecraft worlds, which challenge the racism pervasive in his work. Weird fiction is a subgenre of speculative fiction, which often deals with the horrors of monsters, aliens, and the unknown. And Ruthanna's latest novel, A Half-Built Garden, begins with humans meeting aliens. But we learn pretty quickly that, strange and incomprehensible as these aliens are, fear is not the only response we can have to the unknown. A Half-Built Garden is a story of bridging the divide between the familiar and the alien, a story of hope and progress despite immense challenges, and honestly, one of the most unique and exciting speculative novels I've read in a long time. So, if you want to know what happens when a solarpunk world is suddenly visited by aliens, and what lessons this might hold for our own world, well, then stay tuned.
I'm Ruthanna Emeris. I mostly use she, her pronouns. I am an author of speculative fiction and frequently hope punk and solar punk.
Great. So something I've heard you talk about a little bit in other podcasts, but I'd love to expand on more, is that you have a background in cognitive psychology. I'm just really interested how you came to fiction writing from a science background and how it influences your work.
So really, I came to science from a fiction writing background. I have been writing fiction as long as I was capable of writing. And, you know, some of it was Three Bears fanfic, but definitely before I got into science. Somewhere in my late teens, I discovered a description of cognitive science as combining philosophy and computer science and psychology and linguistics, all trying to figure out how people think. And I thought, that sounds like something I'm interested in. So I think I come to science, you know, as someone who has been writing speculative fiction and as someone who therefore thinks science fictionally about what questions can we ask. And then turning around and come back to fiction with, okay, so if this thing happens, how realistically are people going to react to it? What is the range of ways to be human? And those are questions I sort of address with different methods in writing and science.
Great. You want to talk about the methods you use, maybe the differences between fiction and science methods for answering those questions?
So, as a scientist, you have to run very carefully controlled experiments with little incremental changes. And, I had originally started out with studying memory, and a lot of my interest was in reconstructive memory and how people tell themselves stories about what's happened to them, and then how we, integrate memories of things that actually happened with things that we encountered in stories. And you really have to keep it relatively narrow so that you can actually answer the question with evidence. And then when I'm writing, it's much broader, more speculative. Well, if this is true, then XYZ, and if XYZ, then all this other stuff. So it's jumping further ahead and further out, and it's not coming up with as clear of answers as science does when you're very, very, very lucky. But it is sort of mapping in advance.
That makes a lot of sense. So speaking of jumping ahead, when I was researching for this episode, I had to learn a little bit about what weird fiction is. That's a term I'm not as familiar with. And it's, I guess, a subgenre or a part of speculative fiction. So I'm interested in, I guess, what is the weird, first of all, and what's speculative about it?
This is a can of worms question. One year I went to Necronomicon, which is the big weird fiction convention, and every single panel turned into a discussion of what is weird fiction. For myself, I take a fairly broad view of it, partly because I work on a column with Ann Pillsworth called Reading the Weird, and we like to have broad definitions so that we can include as much stuff as possible in the stories that we cover. So there's a couple of different definitions that I use sort of overlapping. One is that weird fiction is questioning the limits of human understanding and things that humans are prepared to respond to. So, what things are we not capable of fully perceiving? What things are we not capable of fully understanding? And what does it mean to encounter those? And then you have a portion of weird fiction that is really playing like any other subgenre with a relatively standard set of tropes around, ancient gods and books that will drive you mad to read, and people taking over other people's bodies and minds. And, we're willing to take anything that is engaging in those conversations and cover it, even if it's asking different questions about those tropes. And then I tend to feel that just sort of as a honorary degree, anything about the ocean being scary goes under weird fiction. And with all of those, the stuff that I am particularly interested in is both the questions about the limits of human psychology and the questions about how we should respond to not understanding things. Because part of the reason weird fiction frequently, but not always, falls under horror is that often people's answer to the question of what should we do about things we don't understand is be terrified of it. And sometimes, yes, and sometimes there's a wider range of interesting and useful responses, and that's something that I've been very interested in exploring and in finding other things that explore.
It's a really fascinating connection that it's often horror, but not intrinsically. So I want to talk about a particular weird fiction author who we're probably all thinking of. H.P. Lovecraft is a
Very interesting figure in literature, very, very influential and very deeply racist. And I'm curious how you position yourself as a weird fiction author, with Lovecraft kind of hanging over everything, how you reckon with that, either individually or, as a weird fiction community.
So, as a weird fiction author myself, I definitely got into the area by deconstructing Lovecraft. He's a pivotal figure in weird fiction, although he himself was influenced by earlier authors like James and Poe, and has in turn influenced all sorts of different directions of weird fiction and cosmic horror since then. He was, as you say, extremely racist. Even by the standards of the time, his friends were known to comment on it. He was also a deeply frightened person. And when you do read his stuff, if you do read his stuff, there is just this seamless, holistic fear of things that are not white Anglo-Saxon civilization. And some of those things are dimensions beyond our ken, and some of those are old houses, and some of those are people speaking languages that aren't English on the streets of New York City. It's terrifying. And it's interesting because so often when authors are prejudiced, and there are many authors out there with many prejudices, you're going along and you're reading all the stuff that is great in their work, and suddenly you trip over them saying something horrible about Jewish people. And then you're going along and there's the great bit and there's the terrible bit and there's the great bit and there's the terrible bit, if there are great bits at all. But it definitely makes their stuff worse, and it gets in the way of the things they're good at. For Lovecraft, the stuff he was good at and the stuff he was bad at, utterly inextricable. Like, you cannot separate the way that he describes ancient gods who can crush you without even noticing that you exist from the way that he describes black people or Jewish people. And sometimes it's even the same language. And I have a very Lovecraftian emotional response to this, which is that a lot of what Lovecraft writes about is being both attracted to and repulsed by the thing that is different and incomprehensible. So, like, the reason I couldn't just ignore Lovecraft was because of this connection between the horrible stuff and the amazing and original stuff. And so when I approach Lovecraft, it ends up being just this like love-hate letter that is about, like I said earlier, what should you actually do about a universe where most of the universe is not like you, and the things that you take for granted as central to reality are not actually important. And your civilization is not important, and your species is not important. And maybe Lovecraft's response to this was not the correct response. And the way I actually got into this was that my wife was reading me Lovecraft stories while I made dinner, and she read to me The Shadow over Innsmouth. And The Shadow over Innsmouth starts with being told that all of the residents of this terrifying town have been raided by the government and put in concentration camps.
Oh, wow.
And for me, as a modern Jewish reader, if you start a story that way, I'm going to be sympathetic to a group of people, and it's not the group of people who are the people in the concentration camps.
Yeah.
And so I paced around for like an hour going, nobody needs a story about oppressed fish people in concentration camps. No one needs a story about oppressed fish people in concentration camps. And I wrote a story about oppressed fish people in concentration camps, and I got a novelette and two novels out of that, which apparently, at least A lot. So, a lot of, and a lot of what I ended up doing there is I got very interested in what's prejudice really like? And, Lovecraft gives you this completely unselfconscious insight into what's going on in the heads of bigots. And so I did a lot of thinking about, how is oppression the same regardless of who's being oppressed, and how is it different? So rather than having, deep ones standing in for Jewish people or queer people, I ended up with a lot of deep ones. A lot of Jewish people and queer people and people of color and people who had been in Japanese internment camps, all sort of working together and, dealing with the intersections between all of these different ways of being oppressed and also the genuine existence of giant things beyond our ken that might squash us without noticing us, some of which are government, human governments, and some of which are strange creatures from other dimensions.
Oh, that's such a great answer. I'm seeing now the continuity between your earlier stuff and the book I'm really excited to talk about today. Not that I'm not all of a sudden excited and all these other things. So I want to talk a little bit real quick before we dive in about monsters. I put monsters in quotes because I think you probably want to deconstruct that concept a little bit. And what it means to have sympathetic monsters in your story, and why that's important.
I identify myself, first off, as a Lovecraftian monster because I am, as I said, the language that he used to describe people speaking Yiddish on the streets of New York, that would be my ancestors, was much the same as the language that he used to describe, scary fish people or aliens from Yuggoth or strange fungi. It's really a matter of, attitude. What type of creature seems to you to be scary and impossible to communicate with? And once you can communicate with someone, are they still a monster? How do you deal with people who do feel monstrous to you, even when you are talking to them? Monstrosity as perception, really.
So I think that leads perfectly into A Half-Built Garden, which is I often see it categorized as a solar punk or hope punk or speculative fiction book, but it's equally weird fiction. It's equally, I mean, almost a cosmic horror, although horror is not, as we learn, the only response you can have. So just as a brief summary for people who haven't read it, although you should. This is a future Earth, a near future, where people are finally starting to get things right. As they say, they've finally found a way to, govern society and make decisions that positively acts on climate, where they are able to, avert future damage, start dealing with the cleanup of the damage that's already been done. And the society that is built, that is half built, I guess, it's a half-built garden. It's very geared around dealing with climate issues. They have this whole like decision-making network where people make decisions collectively to deal with problems that come up, like related to the weather or pollution. So when aliens land one evening, the society is completely unprepared to deal with that sort of issue. And so, it's challenges of communication, it's a first contact story, it's challenges of like dealing with something, as you said, like what are we capable of dealing with? What happens when something comes up all of a sudden that we're completely unprepared for? So I want to start by talking about first contact stories, because it's unusual for climate fiction to also have this element of first contact. I think it's a really exciting synthesis. I'm curious. Why did you want to write a first contact story, and maybe what inspires you about that particular trope?
First contact has always been one of my favorite subgenres, again, because of the questions around how do you communicate with someone who has so little in common and who doesn't share original experiences or methods of perception or species histories. And it's a way of getting at the lesser problems of communication that we have as humans or with other species on our own planet. In this case, it was also, I was thinking about, okay, so right now we've got all these nation state governments that were created to deal with specific sets of problems that happen at specific rates and at specific scales, and that are having a lot of trouble with climate change. And what would a governance structure that was designed to deal with the rate and scale and existential threat level of climate change look like? And then what happens if that governance structure in turn meets something that it's not prepared to deal with? And because this is me, the thing that it wasn't prepared to deal with is aliens. And it could have been just about any sort of black swan event that they were unprepared for, but aliens are fun, and communicating with aliens is fun, and I wanted to do that. And there are also aliens in Wintertide and Deep Roots. I've discovered that one of the things about me that I need to get excited about a book is snarky non-humans, and I'm always looking for different ways to do that. I think in my next one, it's probably going to be an octopus, but it's been Lovecraft's aliens, and then it's been my aliens, and most of what they have in common is thinking they know what's good for humanity one way or another, and having a sense of humor one way or another.
There was a moment at the start of your book, I knew I was gonna like it, when the aliens were playing little excerpts of movies of human media for the humans, and all these media pieces were centered around first contacts that go really well, like where the species are able to coexist or get along. I thought that was a really like refreshing and fun, kind of spirit to take, and it continues throughout the story, even when they're dealing with some really like difficult existential issues and places where communication breaks down and we have to ask really difficult questions. So I thought this outside force, this alien perspective, I guess, added a lot to a story that is also about humans and very real problems that we are facing right now. So I wanted to talk just about what alien perspectives have to offer to fiction, and like if there are things you'd like to see more of. I feel like they're often just this like warmongering force, or just kind of a foil for humanity. But I think they can be more, and I'd love to hear you talk about what they can offer to speculative fiction.
So there's so many things you can do with aliens, and one of those is certainly the standard invasion thing. And I have enjoyed some invasion stories, but in general, I am less excited about what happens if they want to attack us. Humans attack each other all the time. And, there's only so many variations on that with, worse weapons and bigger amounts of energy and, stranger motivations is the part where it probably gets interesting. But then the part where that gets interesting is when you're trying to get past the violence. And then you can center whole stories around trying to come up with a common way to talk at all. And that is something that I find interesting from a psycholinguistics perspective. And but it takes up a whole story, so it's not what I wanted to do here. So I did have the aliens having looked at all of our broadcasts and all of our available media that they could get to, and using that to learn human languages before they got here, and then having the linguist geek in the household get really annoyed because he doesn't get to have learning how to interpret the alien languages plot. So the sort of midway between those two that I'm really interested in is, what are the assumptions that are so foundational to us as a society, as a species, that others might not share? And then what does it look like to talk to people who bring that different perspective? What does that put in the way of talking to each other, and what does that bring to being able to solve problems? I'm also just, as someone with a background in cognitive science, it's fun to create an alien body plan and then figure out how that changes how they think and what they think about, and alien biology, and how does that change how they think about and what assumptions they take. In A Half-Built Garden, one of the things that I was also interested in is that there's a lot of assumptions in a lot of science fiction that inevitably a species that survives, their destiny is to go into space and take up as much space as possible. And while I am, very interested in getting an awesome up close view of Europa or whatever planets are around Alpha Centauri, I find the idea that that is the inevitable alternative to extinction an interesting assumption, and one that really reflects a very modern or imperial growth must be eternal if you aren't going to die thing that is clearly not currently working out very well for us. And so I wanted to set up a situation where we could have a lot of interesting arguments about that. And I also was, this is a very niche question, but I was interested in the question of, what kind of jerk would build a Dyson sphere? And what would it take for someone to build a Dyson sphere and still be worth talking about planets in your solar system and start using them to surround your sun to capture that much energy? Like, this is a weird thing to do, actually. And so the thing I came up with was having two different species on two different planets in their solar system, basically the equivalent of Earth and Mars both actually being inhabited at the same time, and getting to talk to each other relatively early in their technological development, so that by the time they hit climate change, oh, let's start building stuff in between our two orbits that will work for both of us, actually makes sense to them because there's already someone out there to talk to. And so they have come up with these assumptions based on their experience about the logical thing to do in order to have a technologically thriving species is to get off planet and build a relatively controllable set of environments where everyone can get together. And obviously, the thing to do when you have more species is to create this symbiosis with them and get them off planet as quickly as possible. And the humans who have been working very hard to make their planet habitable are not exactly pleased to have people show up and be like, we're here to help, you gotta leave now. And so it sets up this set of arguments and conflicts and questions about what people are willing to do when they have more power and technology that, hopefully suggests some different answers than we've come up with in practice so far on this planet.
Yeah, I really appreciate it's very clear in your world building that, starting from these aliens' body plans and their like history of interaction with each other, it builds a totally comprehensive worldview that is like fundamentally different in those ways. And I really enjoyed seeing tensions play out that were very nuanced, I would say. Like, you know, both the humans and the ringers are, you know, they're both very concerned with motherhood and parenting and ensuring survival for the species, ensuring, like, habitable environments. Like, the goals, the end goals are the same, but the way to get there looks so different when you just have a different biology and a different history. And there's just some really interesting discussion in the book that I would highly recommend to anyone who's interested in these sorts of questions. And I want to also talk about, though, you also explore alternatives that already exist or already make sense within human society. So we see non-nuclear family households, and we see forms of work that aren't capitalist, and different practices around gender and relationships. And I just think it's really interesting that there are also these tensions within your human society, and they're also in many ways, you know, already pursuing alternatives. So I want to talk about, you know, how you, what your thought process was with picking what sort of, I guess, alternative life ways you wanted to explore there. And then we'll talk about the Dandelion Networks in particular.
Like a lot of people, the Ursula Le Guin quote about how impossible it seemed to get away from the divine right of kings and how impossible it seems now to get away from capitalism, mm-hmm. It's echoed in my mind for a long time. And so one of my big questions going into this book was, what might it be that looks as different from what we have now as what we have now is different from the divine right of kings? And so what are some of the options for that? What are different ways of governance? What are different ways of economics? And the governance was really at the center of it. But, you know, economically, I was trying to think of, you know, what can we do for less growth-oriented ways of getting the resources we need to the places where we need it and the people who need it. What can we do that's less extractive, less causing burnout, less making everyone miserable all the time than our current way of doing labor? And a lot of that stuff really, you know, we like to think of economics and governance as different, and they're really not. So it all really comes together with the ways that people are valued for their input into the governance system and for their expertise. And one of the big things there was that people don't identify with the work that they do in the same way anymore. And there's a point where the main character gets into an argument with her parents, and one of the things that happens is they say, well, you're a water chemist, and she says, no, Mom, I'm an expert in water chemistry and also X, Y, Z, and Q. And the idea that there's not this one thing that takes up most of your time and is central to your identity is connected to the way that there's not this one thing that takes up all of your time and has to be central to your identity because it's the thing that you're required to take up most of your time with. And then trying to have people, you know, still working this out and still having arguments about the places where they are still dependent on the old corporations. Because one of the things about the divine right of kings is that it's entirely gone away. You can still talk to people who think that the results of U.S. elections show the will of God, at least when their guy wins. And there are a lot of those. And, you know, even though we don't have the right, divine right of kings the way we used to, the old stuff doesn't go away. And so having those layers of corporate power and old nation states still in place and still doing some things and playing roles in the face of this new way of using and sharing power was something that I hadn't seen a lot of and wanted to do more with, because the world is layered, and unless you get the Chicago Fire, you never have all the new futuristic spires without a lot of the old brick buildings in between them.
Totally. So I want to talk about the dandelion networks or the watershed networks in particular. I think this is a particularly unique aspect of the story. It's, I guess sort of like a social network in that it's connecting everyone virtually and it's got, algorithms. But it's really new. It's really different and it's really well thought out. And I'm just curious what, inspired this idea, how you developed it, and how this network fits into the society that uses it. If it feels very, very integrated, very compatible with the goals and values of this world.
So when I was trying to think of, new types of governance, I thought of some of the work I've gotten to do with citizen science and crowdsourcing projects, and how these are just a very different way of using huge numbers of people, putting in opinions, putting in things they've seen or heard, sharing data, analyzing data, and just this very distributed way of understanding and responding to the world. And what would that look like if you turned it into more of a governance structure? Carl Schrader has done some work on this too. He's got his story with crowdsourced governance in the Hieroglyph Anthology and has used similar ideas in some of his books. But I was really trying to pull from the things I've seen and trying to think about what would this do if you expanded it. And then the other thing I was interested in there was that the way that we currently use machine learning and algorithms, bias from the learning data sets is a huge problem. And it's always struck me that this is a solution turned inside out, because that means an algorithm can tell you what biases are in your data set. What have you been screwing up? If your algorithm is suddenly telling you to hire only white men, you need to look at the decisions you've been making previously. And so the algorithms in the Dandelion networks are designed both to pull out and highlight the biases that people were working with so they can't ignore them, but also to have built-in biases that we want to have, to be biased towards the ethics that we would like to have as a society, but sometimes fail on in the short term. So they have algorithms that are biased towards the needs of the rivers, drawing on like rights of nature work, and they have algorithms that are biased towards equity, and just all these different things that help to both weight the input of individuals and to add input where it's needed so that you can go in and set the values that you want to be living by, and then have the algorithms helping with that, and then adjust them if you find that they aren't doing that. And I was also thinking about the way that a lot of modern technology, we're really expected to reshape our lives around it. It is designed to pull in our attention, to make us spend a lot of time on specific platforms or playing specific games. It is not designed to make us be, to even facilitate us, I should say, living happy, healthy lives rather than getting overwhelmed by doom scrolling. And so one of the things that I was trying to depict in A Half-Built Garden was a set of technology advances that are built around adapting the technology to the well-being of the humans using the technology, not by forcing us to work in any particular way, but by being shaped to fit human psychology rather than the reverse.
Yeah, I think the trick with the technology we have now is understanding that it does have values, whether we pretend it doesn't or not,
Yes.
and we need to consciously make decisions and govern around the technology and make the technology work for us instead of.
Yeah, it's like saying that you can write science that's not political. Everything is political. Are you doing it on purpose? Every technology has values. Are you doing it on purpose?
Totally. So I want to talk more about values and ethics. Something that sort of permeates the story, and especially the characters, the human characters and their relationships and interactions. It's very guided by Jewish spirituality and ethics, and I think that's a really exciting aspect of the story that I don't see a lot in speculative fiction. So I'd love to hear about, you know, what specifically you were working with there and why that's important and why it's a story worth telling.
I was working with Jewish values and ethics. I have always ended up, when I write, having characters who were either overtly Jewish or had aspects of Judaism. This was the book where I realized I could write a book about a bunch of people who are Jewish and who think about questions Jewishly. And, you know, part of the way Jewish ethics works is that you're supposed to have a lot of arguments and debates about ethics, and you know you learn how to debate and how to argue about these things, and that no question is too small, no question is too big. So I wrote characters who do that and who think a lot about Tikkun Olam, which is repair of the world, because I think a lot about Tikkun Olam, and who also think about, you know, how does one keep kosher for Passover if you suddenly find yourself on an alien Dyson sphere and being offered a welcome feast, and, you know, what do you do when you have aliens with whom you have a serious debate going on showing up at your Passover table, and how can you use that to maybe try to illustrate to them how you think about the universe?
That ties into my next question, which is about questions. A feature of the society of the aliens is they have a role, I guess, sort of a job title, whatever jobs and work mean to them. There are people who ask awkward questions. It's their role to ask the questions that are really important and difficult, and you know, are hard to get out. And I love that concept, first of all, and I'm curious where it came from. It sounds like it may have a tie here to human culture and traditions.
Yeah, no, it's a dream job. You know, I would like people to pay me to go around asking awkward questions, which they then have to deal with. But no, I do think it's important, and I think one of the things that you often see as failure modes for attempts at positive societies is falling into ruts and falling into assumptions. And I think that can happen even if you have people whose job it is to question those things, but I think it's useful to have some institutionalized way of revisiting assumptions, revisiting decisions, revisiting things that no one in the room is talking about. And have some way for people to do that without immediately getting kicked out of the room. Plus, it makes for a great snarky alien. Robinson was a lot of fun to write.
Oh, yeah, I think he might be my favorite character. Although it's hard to say, I love them all for different reasons. So I want to talk a bit about motherhood and parenthood. It features very prominently in the story. I like that it's not... Motherhood isn't just, like, something that's also happening. It's actually central to the plot, to the issues that come up and how they're dealt with. So I'd love to talk about what fiction writing is maybe typically missing about motherhood and parenthood, and what stories are we not seeing. And also, you know, if it feels relevant, your experience in the industry as a writer getting published and also being a mother.
Fiction, I think, does a lot with parenthood and motherhood, but it does it in specific ways because there are specific sorts of plots and foci that literary fiction tends to do, like any other genre. And in more adventure-oriented genres like speculative fiction, it's relatively rare to see parenthood portrayed as something other than what you do after you have the story, or else as a barrier to the story. You gotta find a babysitter so you can go out and fight the demon. And my experience of parenthood is that it really permeates the way I think about the big problems in the world. You know, my kids are having to live with all the political decisions and all of the environmental successes and failures that society is having. And that is part of caretaking for me, is caring about those things and trying to find time around changing diapers to deal with those things. And so I wanted to write a story in which being a parent was central to the adventure, and people got to go out and have adventures while being parents, because that's something I don't see very often. And the way I ended up doing this was by making parenthood also central to the way that the aliens think about negotiation, because of the way one of the species works biologically, where you basically have to convince several other people to, you know, donate their DNA equivalent to you in order to produce offspring. They think of having a baby as a demonstration of your social skill and of your ability to lead. And so they wouldn't dream of sending anyone to a high-stakes first contact situation who was not currently nursing, or their equivalent of nursing. And therefore, because our main characters happened to show up with a baby because they weren't expecting to be in a high-stakes first contact situation, they immediately get glommed onto as, these are the humans who know how to do a negotiation, and we're not going to talk to anyone else. And so they are having to deal with their very different ideas about how you protect kids, and how what being a parent says about you, and what being a mother, for various definitions of mother, says about you. And plus, I get to have human and alien toddlers learning to play together, which was also fun.
So you touched on something there I want to get into a little more, how motherhood can have varying definitions. And we see that in A Half-Built Garden, where the aliens, at least the way they've, you know, adopted human speech, they use gendered pronouns. And there are moments in the book where, you know, they're picking pronoun pins to wear at a meeting, and it's a very, like, heated, intense moment. And there's, you know, different ways that the different human factions deal with gender, and whether it's like presentation or something you feel and how you express it. And unfortunately, I feel like this didn't click with some readers. I've seen this with other speculative fiction books
There's
too.
always people who are going to freak out when you have neo pronouns.
Yeah.
And like, there are a lot of neo pronouns in this book. I needed to specifically give a list to the copy editor and then say, make sure I haven't misgendered any of the people using these 10 different pronoun sets. And I highly recommend for any science fiction authors who may be listening not to write characters whose pronouns change regularly over the course of a few hours, depending on the social roles they're playing. That was challenging to keep up with. I'm glad I did it, but hard to recommend as a editing experience.
Well, I am glad you did it too. I feel like there's actually a lot of really interesting stuff going on there. I mean, you know, we have gender theory because there are theories of what gender is, and these are discussions worth having. If you want to talk a little bit about how you got there, even if, you know, it was a grueling process, I'm just curious what, you know, why that felt significant, because it did really
Sure.
hit me
So
as the reader.
the main human household and the Dandelion networks in general have a gender culture that is pretty recognizably descended from the ones that you currently see in progressive circles. People are expected, if they care about what pronouns people are using, to grab a pin and, you know, label their gender however they're presenting. And you, if you are setting a proper dinner party up, you are expected to put out a basket of pronoun pins so that people can pick them as they come in. And there are, you know, relatively common he, she, and they, and then people can use various others, and people can change around if they want, but you're expected to label fairly straightforwardly. And then you have the corporate culture, which has seriously appropriated 80s glam rock and thinks that your true gender is 100% absolutely nobody's business, and pick their pronouns and gender presentation based entirely on what social role they want to be playing in the constant high stakes social games that their society is built around. And putting a label with the specific pronouns would be being terribly gauche and would be patronizing all the people around you and suggesting that they can't understand the very nuanced things that you're saying with your current outfit. And then you have the aliens, who one set has, you know, is bi-gendered, mirrored more or less in the same way humans are biologically, and has a lot of nuance in, I should say, has two basic biological sexes with a spectrum between them as human does, and has the same sort of nuanced experiences of gender that humans do, but in this particular case, a little bit less language and cultural support for it. And also has this complicated thing where males hatch several years after their older sisters, and their older sisters are expected to raise them. And then you have the other species that is single-sexed biologically, and which set of hormones and what reproductive role you're playing are entirely to do with these very complicated negotiations and dominance displays. And then at some point you stabilize into one person who's going to be the mom and bear the child, and all of the sires who are going to play a subordinate role until the child is grown. And so they're matriarchal, except that anyone can be a matriarch if they do things in the right way. And they find it very weird that humans are like, okay, well, if one of your sires says that they want they them pronouns, we're going to use they them pronouns, and what are you going to do about it?
Thanks for getting into that. Yeah.
So yeah, so that was fun to play with, and it was fun to play with all of this, you know, deep tension around who is going to use what pronouns for which aliens, and the aliens wanting to know who is actually a mother, and the humans being like, we're not going to tell you. All these people count as mothers. We're not going to tell you who actually had the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there's so much more we could dig into here. I just, you know, I can't recommend this book enough. I'm sure a lot of listeners are already familiar. Maybe it's sitting on their to-read list. I'd really, really recommend it if any of these topics hit things you're interested in. And I want to, I guess, zoom out a bit to conclude. So talking more generally about Hope Punk and Solar Punk, which, you know, are both sort of optimistic or hopeful genres within speculative fiction. I guess I'm curious why it appeals to you as a writer, why you know, it's a lot of work to write a book. So what carries you through to produce, you know, a hopeful, optimistic future, and why is it worth reading?
I really like Mariam Kaba's quote about hope is a discipline. I am less interested in trying to predict whether the future is going to be a good one and more interested in the discipline of trying to make a good future. And I feel like one of the things that I can do as an author is to try and imagine things to aim towards and what is something we can reach from here? What does that look like? And as a reader, I think it expands your ideas about what might be possible and what directions we might go. And I think that's important because I think it can be very easy to fall into, am I right about whether we can get somewhere good? Am I being silly to think we can get somewhere? And I'm trying to write towards not making it your job to figure out whether it's possible, just trying to do the work of making it possible. Because the one thing we do know is the more work that we do to make it possible, the better it's likely to turn out. And the less work we do, the worse it's likely to turn out.
So, do you have anything to say to, I guess, the so-called doomers out there, those who just feel like it's not going to work out, we shouldn't even try?
I think I just said it. Hope is a discipline. It's not a prediction. It's, I mean, I guess it takes less energy to not even try, but it doesn't seem to result in people being happier. And, we're not here to say, I told you so. We're here to try and fix as much as we can fix.
Great. So, before the final question, I just want to give you a chance if there's anything you're working on, anything you want to put out there for people who are hoping for more.
Currently, I'm doing something a little bit different, which is that I am working on an introduction to and footnotes for a new edition of The Willows out of Lanternfish Press, which is a classic piece of weird fiction by Algernon Blackwood about rivers and the weird things that happen on rivers, which I think is why I got tapped for this. Was watersheds and the weird things that happen on watersheds. So I'm working on that, and I think that'll probably come out sometime next year. And then in terms of books, I'm currently playing around with talking octopuses and weird things that can go wrong with algorithms and high seas heists to try and improve water quality sensing. So we'll see where that goes.
That sounds super exciting. So, my last question for you, to sort of leave everyone on a thoughtful, speculative note, is what does utopia look like to you?
The most believable utopia that really got me started thinking about this stuff when I was younger was Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time. And there's a lot of her mouth of Mattapoisett in my Chesapeake Bay watershed. And that's still sort of my go-to for thinking about, how might the future be different? How might we think about ourselves and our society and our relationship to each other differently?
Solarpunk Now is written, hosted, and produced by me, Luca Dowell. The Solarpunk theme song is by Red Keener on SoundCloud. My guest today was Ruthanna Emeris, author of A Half-Built Garden. You can find her on Twitter at r_Emeris, Mastodon at r_Emeris at wandering.shop, or check out her website at ruthannaemeris.com. You can follow me on Twitter at SolarpunkCast, Mastodon at SolarpunkCast at spore.social, or visit solarpunkcast.net for all episodes, including show notes. You can also visit solarpunkcast.net to donate to the show. Running a podcast takes time and money, and I do all of this myself, so your support is greatly appreciated. That's solarpunkcast.net, link in the description. And remember, the realization of any vision requires action. I strongly encourage you to get involved with local organizations whose goals align with the brighter future you want to see. Analysis is important, but we have to back it up with practice. Keep dreaming big, and keep up the good work.